This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight,
we have now 815 million people suffering from hunger in 2016.
That's FAO Director General Jose Graziano da Silva launching the new UN report on global hunger. We'll have details coming up. Also, the displacement crisis in Central African Republic reaches record levels and is the worst since conflict erupted there in 2013. Islamic State claims responsibility for this week's ambush of a police convoy in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula. And as Liberians get ready for the presidential election on October 10th, top candidates launch their campaigns. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Well, after more than a decade of progress, the UN warns global hunger is again on the rise. About 815 million people go hungry every day, an increase of nearly 40 million from 2015 to 2016. That's according to the latest report on the state of food security and nutrition in the world. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The report says the increase in hungry people is mostly due to conflict and climate-related shocks, such as droughts, floods, and storms. For the first time, five UN agencies have co-published the annual report: the Food and Agriculture Organization, World Food Program, International Fund for Agricultural Development, World Health Organization, and UNICEF. José Graziano da Silva is FAO Director General.
We have now 815 million people suffering from hunger in 2016. Let me highlight that we are reporting 1 year ago. Hope this year, 17, the numbers will be better.
He says the prevalence of undernourished people has also increased.
It is now up to 11% of the world population, the same level of 5 years ago, 2012. This means that in 2016, 1 in 9 people in the world is going to bed hungry every day.
The FAO chief says the increase comes just 2 years after nations agreed to eradicate hunger and extreme poverty by 2030. He says the world's food security has deteriorated in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa and Asia. The famine-like conditions in South Sudan, Somalia, northeast Nigeria, and Yemen are blamed on a combination of conflict and drought. About 20 million people are affected. In South America, much of the hunger problems are attributed to faltering economies, where unemployment is high.
In this scenario, we may well see the return of hunger to countries where it had been eradicated or were very near to do so.
World Food Program Executive Director David Beasley says that man-made conflict creates crisis, hunger, and starvation, and tears apart societies. He says for every 1% increase in hunger, there's a 2% increase in migration. Man-made conflict has taken a heavy toll, with children among the hardest hit.
There are 155 million stunted children in the world, a reduction, but in the war zones, 122 million, 75% of them in conflict zones. 60% of the world's 815 million hungry people live in conflict zones. That's 489 million preventable man-made hungry people.
The WFP leader says political, not military, solutions are needed to end the four biggest humanitarian crises.
So we call upon the leaders of the world to come together and apply the pressure that's necessary to end these conflicts so we can achieve zero hunger around the world. But this is a shame. This is an indictment upon humanity. With all the successes of technology and wealth today, we should be absolutely going the other direction.
UNICEF Executive Director Anthony Lake reiterates the report's warning about children.
Millions of children across northeast Nigeria, Somalia, South Sudan, Yemen, and elsewhere, innocent victims of a deadly combination of protracted, irresponsible conflicts, of drought, poverty, and climate change. Living through crises defined not only by hunger and ruined crops, but by preventable diseases like cholera and measles, displacement, and interrupted education. A generation of children at risk.
EFAT President Gilbert Hongbo agrees that hunger is often a man-made problem.
The conditions that create hunger are clearly linked to weak policy, poor governance, and the lack of sustained commitment in support of national and global food security policies and actions.
WHO Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus warns of poor nutrition's link to obesity and non-communicable diseases, especially in poorer countries. These include cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and cancer.
Unhealthy eating is the leading cause of disease globally, and maternal and child undernutrition and obesity rank in the top 10. By addressing these risks, we can prevent or delay around one quarter of all deaths annually.
The leaders of the UN agencies say the State of Food Security and Nutrition in the World report has set off alarm bells that cannot be ignored. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The UN Refugee Agency warns the displacement crisis in Central African Republic has reached record levels and is the worst since conflict erupted there in 2013. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UNHCR reports the total number of people displaced by conflict in Central African Republic now stands at more than 1.1 million. This includes more than 500,000 who fled to neighboring countries in search of refuge and another 600,000 who are internally displaced. Refugees had been returning to CAR gradually since the end of last year as peace efforts began to pay off. But the UNHCR says all this came to a halt in mid-May. That is when fierce clashes erupted among armed groups, leading to a new wave of displacement, increased suffering, death, and destruction of property. UNHCR spokeswoman Ekaterini Kitidi tells VOA much of the violence is taking place along the border with countries of refuge.
You see people crossing the border directly in a very bad situation, wounded and with many of their relatives killed. The people have told us many stories of looting, of properties, of destruction of properties, of sexual crimes, of killings, many atrocities taking place.
The UNHCR reports more than 167,000 refugees have fled to Democratic Republic of Congo, nearly 40% due to the recent fighting in CAR. Refugee arrivals also have increased in Cameroon, Republic of Congo, and Chad. About 15 armed groups fighting in CAR include the former Muslim Seleka, the Christian Anti-Balaka, and splinter groups from these main fighting forces. Aid agencies, including the UNHCR, report their staff increasingly are among those targeted by armed groups, forcing their temporary withdrawal in some instances. The UNHCR says this is impeding the delivery of critical aid to the displaced. It notes increased insecurity in the country is preventing aid agencies from assessing the full extent of damage or displacement from the recent violence. The agency says the presence of armed groups also has delayed or blocked some planned deliveries of humanitarian aid by air. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Nigeria, state governors are calling for calm after growing clashes between authorities and Igbo activists. They're advocating for the establishment of an independent state in the southeast called Biafra. The French press agency says the governor of Plateau State, Simon Lalong, met today with representatives of the Hausa and Igbo communities. This after market clashes that reportedly killed two people. He's also called for a dusk to dawn curfew. Supporters of the Indigenous People of Biafra Movement, or IPOV, have also clashed this week with security services in the southern state of Abia and in the city of Port Harcourt in River State. Also in Nigeria, the United Labor Congress, ULC, is threatening to go on strike. The group wants better working conditions for its members in the several sectors, including oil and gas, telecoms, and electricity. According to the French press agency, the head of the ULC, Joe Ajero, has given the government until tonight to meet its demands. They include a new minimum wage of $156 per month and a withdrawal of army personnel at oil installations. The government says any strike is illegal and it does not recognize the ULC, which broke away from the Nigeria Labor Congress last year. The Islamic State has claimed responsibility for this week's ambush of a police convoy in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula. Officials say 8 police officers and soldiers died in the attack. It was the deadliest assault in the northern Sinai in months. The attack took place on Monday, about 30 kilometers west of El Arish, a stronghold of a long-running insurgency. David DeRoche is a professor at Center for Strategic Studies at the National Defense University in Washington, D.C. He explains to VOA's Mohammed Al-Shanawi why the insurgency is getting worse in spite of a multi-year campaign by the Egyptian army.
Well, the insurgency in the Sinai is in a situation where it's just getting worse and worse. What you've seen, particularly in the northern Sinai, is you have an alienated population, the presence of criminal bands that have made money off of smuggling into Gaza, and the introduction of, you know, a serious Daesh component. The problem is, the reason why the situation is getting worse, is that the Egyptian security forces seem to be focusing on the last factor to the exclusion of all others, and have engaged in a mode of policing that probably is counterproductive.
So what else they should have been doing instead of just resorting to brutal force?
Many aspects of the Egyptian state are not providing the proper level of services and the proper level of participation for Egyptian citizens. The problem seems to be particularly worse in the Sinai, and what you see is basically the people in the Sinai have no stake in the Egyptian state because it doesn't provide anything, it's seen as oppressive. And when you have an incident like this, the security apparatus seems to be moving in a heavy-handed manner that alienates more people than it brings back in. So what you're seeing is a breakdown in law and order where the population has to be policed, not governed, and the spiral of violence just gets tighter and tighter.
Mohammed Anwar Sadat, chairman of the Reform Party in Egypt, is calling on the government to reconsider its counterterrorism strategy and listen to the Sinai residents and respond to their grievances. What's your take on such a call?
I think that's pretty wise. That's about the only thing that will help the Egyptians get out of the position they're in the Sinai. If you look historically at how, you know, insurgencies among alienated populations have been resolved, usually there has to be some expansion of political participation. The people in there have to feel that they're a little bit more empowered. And unfortunately, the Egyptian security apparatus still seems to think that it can just force a solution, which, you know, hasn't worked and probably won't work.
The United States State Department mourned the victims of the attack in Sinai and stressed the U.S. backing of the Egyptian efforts in combating terrorism. Does that mean the U.S. does not realize the insurgency aspect of the problem in Sinai?
No, I don't think so. It's just that, you know, I mean, 18 police officers, that is a tragedy. These are dedicated men who, you know, served the Egyptian people and who wanted to make Egypt, you know, a safer, more secure state. So for them to die, I mean, that's awful. And there's no contradiction in recognizing the noble sacrifice of the Egyptian security services, but at the same time saying, look, maybe we need to rethink this.
Is President Sisi emboldened by President Trump's support for combating terrorism in the area?
I think he is. Certainly more than he would be under the Obama administration. But President Sisi should not mistake this. You know, President Trump, at the end of the day, is not driven by external policy. His agenda is internal, And if this situation doesn't get better, he's going to find that American patience is limited. So, you know, he has probably got more freedom than he would have under a Hillary Clinton presidency, but he does not have a blank check.
That was David DeRoche, a professor at the Center for Strategic Studies at the National Defense Ministry or University. He spoke to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy. And it's 20 minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. As Liberians get ready for the presidential election on October 10th, numerous candidates have launched their campaigns for the top job in the country. Our colleague James Butte is in Monrovia. He says one of the top five candidates officially kicked off his campaign today, promising a tsunami crowd turnout of voters.
They are counting down the days before this very crucial election in the history of this country. In fact, Friday today marks 25 more days before Liberians are cast their ballots. One of the top five presidential candidates, in the name of businessman Benoni Ure, who happens to be the standard bearer of the All Liberian Party, is officially launching his campaign in the capital city, Monrovia. He has promised to, what he said, lock down the city with what he calls a tsunami crowd.
So when is the ruling Unity Party launching its campaign in the capital city?
The Unity Party officially will launch its campaign tomorrow, Saturday, here in Monrovia. And the presidential candidate is current Vice President Joseph Boakai. I had the opportunity to interview Vice President Boakai yesterday, Thursday, and he has also promised a tsunami turnout. He said that his supporters will produce the largest political rally crowd that this city has ever seen. In fact, a leading daily newspaper here, Front Page Africa, has a cover story with the headline, Tsunami Competition. So now it will be up to the people of Monrovia to say which party will produce the largest campaign rally in this election cycle. Whether that would determine which candidate will have the momentum going into the final days of the election, I really can't say.
Will President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf be at her vice president's political rally tomorrow?
That's the biggest speculation here in Monrovia, in fact, in the whole country. But I can say that she will not be attending a vice president's campaign rally tomorrow, Saturday. As I mentioned earlier, I spoke with the vice president yesterday and asked him whether the president supports his vice president Boakai's campaign. The vice president said, and I will quote, "I cannot say I do not need support from a partisan of the Unity Party. All partisans of the Unity Party, including the president, their contributions to the party are welcome. So I cannot say that a president who has been at the helm of this party for 12 years, I cannot say I would need her help. If it is not forthcoming, well, but I cannot say I would need it. I need everybody's contribution." So there you have it, the vice president of Liberia for the last 12 years speaking with uncertainty whether this current president is going to support his political rally tomorrow, Saturday. In fact, the President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf went on the state broadcast last night to say that she will not be at Vice President Boakai's campaign rally tomorrow, Saturday.
That was our colleague James Butte in Monrovia, Liberia. Well, over now to Ghana, where the government has made education at the secondary high school level free nationwide. The president rolled out the program this week, calling it a necessary investment in the nation's future workforce. But there are some concerns about the program's implementation. Francesca Cockra-Forson reports from Accra.
The response to Ghana's new free secondary high school policy has been enthusiastic. Okay. Parents and students formed long lines at public schools around Accra this week to register before classes open Monday, 18 September. The West Africa Secondary School expects to admit close to 700 new students this year. Freshman Charity Odro smiled as she waited her turn. She will be studying business.
Are you excited about it?
Yes.
Why? Tell me why you're excited.
Okay. Because my parents don't have money, so Yes, I'm going for free education.
Ghana introduced free compulsory education at the primary and junior high school levels in 1995 as required by the Constitution. But implementation did not happen overnight. It was not until 2014 that the World Bank said Ghana had achieved near universal access at the primary level. Extending that policy to SHS or secondary high school was a major campaign promise of President Nana Akufo-Addo.
The countries that have made rapid progress around the world put education at the heart of their development.
The president announced the launch of the free SHS program Tuesday.
Our economy, for over a century, has been dependent largely on the production and export of raw materials. This cannot and will not create prosperity for the masses of Ghanaians.
Ghana will be spending an estimated $100 million or 400 million cedis for the new program in its first year. The government expects the annual cost to go down in subsequent years. Students will be paying nothing. The government will cover their tuition, textbooks, hot meals, school uniforms, and other expenses. The goal is to increase enrollment and curb dropouts. Ghana's education ministry says it found that as many as 100,000 students pass the basic education certificate examination each year, but then drop out of high school because their families can't afford it. Libaba Mohammed enrolled her daughter this week.
She can't pass plenty of things because if you bring your child from the school like this, you pay money.
You're not paying anything?
No.
So you're not paying school fees?
No.
But not everyone is pleased. Private schools complain their enrollment is suffering. Joseph Jamesi is with the Conference of Heads of Private Second Cycle Schools.
What is to happen to 10,000 plus Ghanaian workers who are currently employed in our schools? What is government's plan to provide a platform that gives our schools a realistic chance to thrive? We therefore call on government to, as a matter of urgency, one, include private SHS among the schools listed on the self-placement website. Secondly, we call on government to extend its policy on free SHS to cover students in private senior high schools also.
I caught up with the Minister for Education, Matthew Opoku-Prempeh, for some answers.
We've had free compulsory universal basic education for over 10 years now, making basic schools free. But the most thriving sector within the basic schools are the private. We, as a party, as a government in power, don't want to kick out the private sector. No. Our intent is to provide quality education, remove financial burden for parents who can't, in the public space. Some students choose to go to private schools. The records are there. So they should be looking within themselves, looking at the space, charting a niche for themselves, and offering competitive services.
But is this public SHS system ready for such a large influx of new students this year? There are concerns of congestion or a drop in quality. The education minister said the government based its calculations on input from headmasters and the total number of students who passed the entrance exam.
We should be able to please everybody.
The government has pledged to carry on with a separate $156 million project begun in 2014 with funding from the World Bank to improve learning outcomes for secondary high school students. Francisca Kakra-Forsen for VOA News, Accra.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and thanks for choosing the VOA.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.